Up, a defense analyst weighs in on Iraq and what's turning out to be one of the deadliest months for U.S. troops there. But first, the U.N. General Assembly is voting today to fill a seat on the Security Council. Venezuela is fighting off a challenge from Guatemala for the seat, and Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, always good for a soundbite, gave this advice to his U.N. ambassador, go forth with a bayonet. Well, here with an update on the vote is Maggie Farley, U.N. Bureau Chief for the L.A. Times. And Maggie's always colorful language from the Venezuelan president. But is it working? I know there was a first-round vote. How'd it go?
Actually, his colorful language might have backfired on him because Venezuela lost the first round. Guatemala got 109 votes. Venezuela got 76. There were 7 abstentions.
Well, and what was the expectation? Because especially with the run-up to this vote, we know of President Chavez's fiery speech before the council, saying that President Bush was the devil, saying he could smell the sulfur in the pulpit the day after Bush stood there. Did that also impact his chances or increase them?
Well, yes, it got a lot of attention the day that he did it, and I think that it tapped into an undercurrent of resentment against the United States' dominance in the Security Council and the United Nations. But when people have to sit down to vote, I think they were turned off by the speech in the end because they realized that having Venezuela as a member of the Security Council would make it work less efficiently.
What about other factors? I'm thinking of Venezuela's ties to North Korea and Iran and the timing.
Exactly. North Korea and Iran are at the top of the agenda for the Security Council right now. Security Council actually came together on Saturday to vote unanimously for sanctions against North Korea. One of the permanent members who had been against the sanctions at first but eventually came around, who didn't want to be identified, but he told me just a few minutes ago, if Venezuela had been there, it would not have been a 15-0 vote.
Mm-hmm. And so are you thinking that members are taking that into consideration?
I think that's a prime consideration, especially because Iran is about to come on the agenda, and those two will remain on the agenda. There'll be big issues for the Security Council, and if Venezuela is their protectors there, it will make it harder to get work done.
And let's remind ourselves, why is this battle between Venezuela and Guatemala?
Well, there are 15 members of the Security Council. 5 are permanent, and then 10 are temporary. They hold 2-year seats. Every year, 5 of them rotate. So this is for 5 of the rotating seats.
And this is the seat that belongs to Latin America.
To Latin America, right.
And Hugo Chavez is saying that he would be the voice of third world countries. What is Guatemala saying to make its case?
Guatemala is saying that it would be more representative of the region and more representative of the world, and that it'd be a constructive member of the Security Council and wouldn't be at odds. It could still represent the developing world, but in a way that would be constructive.
We know that Guatemala is coming out of years of a U.S.-backed dictatorship and has never had a seat on the council, but is considered a leading contributor to U.N. peacekeeping missions?
That's right. And so they say that they're already a contributing member of the U.N. community, and they would work with it, not against it.
Yeah. So what is the sense? Again, there's going to be another round of voting. What is the sense of what might happen? Do you think there will be a surprise, an upset, a turnaround? And if Venezuela does lose, what does that mean? What message will that deliver to other countries?
If Venezuela loses, because they had a strong lead, or Venezuela claimed they had a strong lead, and even Guatemala conceded that before Chavez's speech, I think the message would be a vote of no confidence against Chavez's tactics.
And what happens if neither country wins? Is that possible?
It is possible, and the record is 154 rounds in 1979, Cuba versus Colombia.
Wait, and we just had the first one.
That's right.
A little while ago.
It went on for months. It started in October and ended in January, and only after the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, which made Cuba lose a lot of votes. So they bowed out, and then Colombia bowed out, and Mexico ended up the winner. So people are talking about potential compromise candidates if there really is a stalemate, but we're still only in the second round.
So they could just pick another. They could just, the Latin American bloc could just nominate another country?
They could. The Venezuelan special envoy said, it took Cuba 154 rounds. We'll go 155 if it's necessary.
Well, Maggie Farley, you've just taken some of the urgency out of our report this morning, but thank you so much for filling us in. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Maggie Farley, UN Bureau Chief of the LA Times. October is turning into one of the deadliest months for American troops in Iraq. The military says a dozen troops have been killed since Friday, bringing the total to 50 for the month. Meanwhile, the death toll from sectarian violence in the Iraqi city of Balad is now topping 90. Authorities say a militia loyal to an anti-American cleric is killing Sunni men and boys with the help of police. Also, two car bombs killed at least 15 people and wounded more than two dozen others in eastern Baghdad today. We occasionally invite analysts in to weigh in on Iraq, and today we want to spend some time with a familiar voice, defense analyst Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp. He teaches at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He's also a retired U.S. Special Forces Green Beret, and he walks the talk, so to speak. His 20-year-old twin sons, Travis and Grant, are currently serving in Iraq in Anbar province, and he himself is about to go back to the country later this month. So, Khalif, Colonel Sepp, we want to talk to you first about what looks to us like a divide over what to do in Iraq. And it seems to be illustrated by two top commanders. Peter Schoomaker, chief of staff of the U.S. Army, says the Army is planning for the possibility of keeping troops at the current level of 140,000 through 2010. But then the top British general, Sir Richard Dannett, says Britain should draw down its 7,500 troops, saying whatever good British troops generated after the invasion has turned to intolerance. So first of all, why the difference?
There's not that much of a difference necessarily in what's being presented. What General Schoomaker is discussing is something that the Army always does, the American Army always does, which is plan. They're planning to keep the current level of troops there to 2010. It would be what would fall under worst-case planning, something that they had neglected, that had been neglected by the administration in starting the war, and now is taken much more seriously by the services. So it would be very difficult to keep 140,000 troops in Iraq for the next 4 or 5 years, but it may be required, so they are going to plan for it.
When you say it may be difficult, is one of the concerns that they have to make sure they have troops available?
Absolutely right. The ground forces of the United States, the Army and Marine Corps, are wholly committed to supporting the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq right now. And that means that the troops that aren't actually in the theater of operations, that are back in the United States or their bases in Europe, are actually going through refitting in order to prepare to go back. And only a very, very small reserve remains to respond to any other crises that might develop in the world, like Korea, like Iran, like Pakistan.
What about on the British side? Again, only 7,500 as opposed to 140,000 U.S. troops, but can the U.S. go it alone?
Hopefully, it wouldn't be so much an issue of the United States having to pick up the slack as Iraqi security forces should be able to step in and fill the void that the British would leave on behind when they would pull their troops there out. Mm.
Especially with an eye on two sons in Iraq currently, what do you think has to happen? We hear about the escalating violence. It's mostly sectarian violence, Sunni and Shia against each other, but American soldiers are still dying. What, in your mind, should change?
Analytically speaking, there's really three options. One is staying the course. The other is to surge more troops in, about 40,000 more. Into the country to try and stabilize and bring order to the the most conflictive of the large cities in Iraq, particularly Baghdad.
Well, I want to interrupt for a second because we just recently spoke with Borzu Dargahi, who's the L.A. Times Baghdad bureau chief, and he just did a terrific report on John Gentile, who's a lieutenant colonel with the 4th Infantry, who's just taken all of the troops from a certain area and put them in one trouble spot in Baghdad. And through a unique way of approaching things, for instance, when he realized there were so many suicide bombers at checkpoints, he removed the checkpoints, instructed his men to, not break down doors but walk in them, had a whole new attitude of speaking with the people, and again, flooding all of the troops in one area. It worked. The shops are flourishing, and it's going well. The problem is he had to take troops from other areas in order to do that.
I know John very well.
Oh, you do?
Brilliant officer. We taught together at West Point that he would have taken this particularly enlightened and thoughtful approach that, that yields this kind of success in a counterinsurgency environment is very typical of him. But you raise the question of where will you get the kind of troops that you can draw to concentrate in a particular area to create a secure zone. And there are, in fact, other troops in much more secure areas that would be available. A number of coalition troops, our allies that are in Iraq right now, should be available for this, but their governments restrict them from serving in more dangerous zones than they are now.
Oh, so that's one of the problems. But, you know, since you do know Lieutenant Colonel Gentile, are there maybe not enough Gentiles? Are there a lot of Gentiles, but they're not getting to do what they'd like to do, like remove checkpoints? Talk more about that.
This kind of war tests people in a way that they had not necessarily been prepared for, and some respond extremely well. John Gentile being a terrific example. But others take away very different lessons, respond in different ways. Right now there is a colonel bringing his regiment to combat in Iraq who has said that his personal lesson from his last tour in Iraq when he was fighting in Fallujah in 2004 was that we did not punish the Iraqis enough. He has not adapted. He does not understand the kind of war that he's in, and he's focused on strictly tactical issues, sort of, you know, very at almost primitive level.
Well, you say punish the Iraqis enough. The U.S. was supposed to be liberating them.
That's exactly my point, Robin.
Yeah.
Is that this officer, if he means what he says in the way that he said it, he doesn't understand what it will take to succeed in Iraq.
What do you attribute that to? I'm wondering, is it possible that some in the military, I'm asking you because perhaps you'll know, is it possible that some in the military may have, as some in the American public have, conflated Iraqis with the attackers of 9/11? I mean, is it possible that there are people leading troops who may also have that misunderstanding?
That's exactly one of the things that are involved in this kind of difficulty when you ask, you know, do we have enough good leaders? And this gets back to the way the military has, during the Cold War period, prepared its officers for combat against the Soviets in the large-scale conventional war that was anticipated that we were going to fight in Europe. Mm. And the emphasis became much more on training, because we knew exactly who the enemy was. We were very aware of his tactics. And so we trained people. We were teaching them what to do in that kind of fight. But in these other kinds of wars, education, learning how to think about problems, is much more important. And that's where we're behind in many regards in military education.
How to function in an insurgency.
Absolutely.
We're speaking with military analyst Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp. It's part of our ongoing attempt to learn what defense analysts are thinking about Iraq. When we come back, Colonel Sepp, I want to hear more of your thoughts about having your two twin sons serving in Iraq and more about what it might take to leave the country. Much more coming up with Colonel Sepp here and now. Conversation on Iraq continues now with Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp. He's a former Green Beret. He's a teacher at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. He has been an occasional critic of the way the war in Iraq has been played out, and he's also a father with two sons currently serving in Iraq as twin boys. And Khalif, Colonel Sepp, I want your thoughts on this debate over what to do in Iraq. Should we stay or should we go? You know the debate. Should we pull back to the perimeter is another option? What are the options?
The simplest one that's been advocated is a wholesale withdrawal. Just announce that we're leaving as quickly as you can pack everything up, which would still take about a year. Just get American troops out of the...
It would take a year?
The infrastructure that's been brought into Iraq is extraordinary in its size. And you could get the troops out probably fairly quickly, but then you would have to abandon billions of dollars worth of equipment. You're talking about moving entire towns that we've built all over Iraq, but there's thousands of tanks in the country. Big 70-ton vehicles.
Mm-hmm.
It's tremendous. It's literally millions of tons of equipment.
Huh. So it would take a year, and that would be quick. That would be the quick exit.
That would probably be the quickest way out, and several tens of thousands of troops could be moved fairly quickly. But then withdrawing the rest of it would would simply take a while.
And so when you're talking about a slower withdrawal, because some Americans think when they talk about a slower withdrawal, they're thinking, oh, that's 5 months as opposed to next week. You know, and that's, I think that's a perception. And you're saying the slower one would be a few years.
The slower one would also involve not just moving, you know, taking more time to withdraw troops, but taking on a different purpose for the troops. Instead of having as many combat troops that we have there now, it would involve seriously and significantly increasing the number of advisors that are in the country right now. Right now, we have advisors to the Iraqi security forces at major police station level and at what's called battalion level, which is a group of about 500 soldiers, and we'll have a dozen U.S. advisors in the battalion headquarters overseeing 500 Iraqis that oversees 500 Iraqi soldiers. Where they need the advice is down at the company and even at the platoon level. Companies are groups of about 100 soldiers, and platoons are groups of about 30, where the Iraqi leadership needs to be developed and overwatched, and in particular needs to be restrained. Americans need to be able to have insight into these organizations at all these levels to ensure that they don't use the training that they receive from us and the equipment they receive from us to become armed death squads.
Well, and meanwhile, your boys, your twin sons, 20 years old in Iraq, one a Marine, one a paratrooper, do you speak to them often?
We communicate by email almost every day, and every now and then one of the boys is able to get a telephone call in.
What are they saying to you about what they're doing?
They're very focused on what their jobs are. Travis is a lance corporal, and Grant is a specialist, which is a rank just above private first class. They're concentrating on doing what their sergeants and officers want them to do, and they very much believe that what they're doing helps, helps the United States help Iraq toward its goals.
I'm putting you in a tough position, I know, because here they are, the sons of a defense analyst, and they're probably better able than any troops in the field to see if there's bad leadership, if there's, you know, not enough armor, you know, some of the criticism that we've heard of the military. Do they talk to you about that? Do they tell you they think the mission's going well?
One of the things I'm very pleased about is that they're smart enough to know that they see a very, very small part of the overall war where they are. And they don't pretend to extrapolate or extend their experience across the entire country. The war in Iraq really isn't one war. It's hundreds of wars that are very localized in towns, neighborhoods, and suburbs, and districts. So they don't try to present to me the idea that we're winning or we're losing.
Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp, a defense analyst, a former Green Beret, also a teacher at the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California, and a father with two twin sons serving currently in Iraq. Lieutenant Colonel Sepp, do you think that you sleep easier at night because you are a military family and this is the family business, or do you think it's harder for you to sleep at night because you're a defense analyst and you know so much?
It's actually knowing on a very calculating way what the odds are concerning the dangers that all of our soldiers face in Iraq. A general officer I know retired from the military but remains active in defense affairs has a daughter serving as an officer in Iraq as well. She's an engineer. And I asked him the same question you just asked me. And he had said, you know, it doesn't bother him because these are the risks that that soldiers and Marines take. That they're aware of them, and this is what they do and why they serve. But he said that his wife is very troubled and worries constantly. The scale of combat is a little bit different. This isn't the Second World War. This isn't the operations that the Marines go on aren't like the Tarawa landings, where 800 Marines die within a few hours in a direct assault against fortified positions. It's more insidious. It's risky in a different way. I can't pretend that I don't worry about it. But at the same time, knowing what I know about the competence of most of the commanders that are in Iraq, the quality of the training and the equipment that they have.
And the history of war.
Exactly. These help attenuate my concerns, but do not dispel them completely.
That's Lieutenant Colonel Khalif Sepp from the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, California. Well, a quick look ahead. Tomorrow, how some companies have tried to export patients, sending employees overseas for surgery. We'll find out why one worker thought it was a great idea and why others are worried. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. Funding for Here and Now comes from WB. Increase in the nation's murder rate and the issue of sharing data in terrorism cases has drawn two top White House officials to Boston today. The International Association of Chiefs of Police is meeting here, and they'll listen as U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez unveils a plan to send federal investigators into cities to identify the root causes of violence. Also today, Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff is announcing plans to improve coordination between local police and federal agents investigating terrorism. Well, joining us on the line is Dr. James Fox, professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University here in Boston, also a columnist for the Boston Herald. And, Professor, in your column today, you address the issue of a spike in violent crime in Boston and elsewhere. What do you think is going on?
Well, you know, my response to the Attorney General coming here and saying that we need to investigate the reasons is a big police. I think we know a lot of the reasons why crime is increasing, and much lays at the doorstep of the White House.
How so?
Well, this administration has seen fit to cut and slash dramatically the COPS program, which was such a favorite of Bill Clinton, the 100,000 police officers, which was so helpful to Boston and other cities in terms of providing resources for fighting crime, has been slashed by over 80% since this administration has taken office. And if you look at what's happened with policing, the cities, American cities, have seen a 10% decline in the number of police officers since 2000. That's a dramatic drop. The rest of the country, by the way, the rural areas and the heartland, they've seen no change at all. Secondly, this administration seems very chummy with the gun industry and the gun lobby, and we've seen, for example, new limits being placed on the extent to which police departments can investigate and trace guns that have been used in crime.
Well, you back up your thinking about the Bush administration and its ties to the gun lobbies by pointing out the differences between two reports that have recently been released. One was the summit report of the White House summit, the conference on school safety, and one was the Police Executive Research Forum. Compare and contrast.
Right. Well, last week the president, very concerned about the shootings of schools, had his conference, talked a lot about character education, but not a word about guns. And experts on guns were not invited to the table. How can we talk about school shootings without talking about guns? The school shootings really a rural issue. It has impacted primarily among white America. If you look at what's happened in terms of big city crime, it's primarily impacted on the poor, minorities, and then overwhelmingly it's with guns. So, the Bush administration seems to be looking at one issue, but seems to be ignoring another issue.
But are cities looking at guns? I mean, here in Boston, I know there was talk for a while of guns that were being brought in from Canada, I believe, gun running. I mean, do cities think that the problem is guns, or do they think that it's a lack of jobs? Or,
well, if you look in Boston, for example, the percentage of homicides that involve a gun has continued to rise. The number of shootings is on the rise, and most of these guns are coming from out of state, not necessarily from Canada, but more often from the South. So it's really it's the federal posture about guns that's very troubling.
Well, U.S. Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez is also going to be sending teams to communities where violent crime has decreased. We would assume those communities also have access to guns. Are guns the only factor?
Well, no, guns aren't the only factor. There's about six or seven factors. Guns, a big one, obviously, and the cuts in law enforcement resources, another one. We also have more at-risk youth in our population right now, and we have also seen cuts in prevention programs for kids, cuts in after-school programs, cuts in athletic programs, because we don't want to spend the money. And really, the choice is ours, is to pay for these programs now or pray for the victims later.
Well, we also mentioned that Homeland Security Chief Michael Chertoff is in Boston at this conference today, announcing plans to improve coordination between local police and federal agents investigating terrorism. First of all, is there any connection between the Homeland Security Initiative and local crime?
Sure.
Well, tell.
It's robbing, raping, and murdering from Peter to pay for Paul. Much of the problem with the declining resources for hometown security is a shift of resources over to Homeland Security. Not just money, but also personnel. And having city police spend more time dealing with terrorism and less time dealing with street crime. Now, if you look at, and I don't want to weigh one threat against another, but when you look at the numbers, more people are murdered every year in street violence than were killed on 9/11. Now, what's the difference between the two? Well, people who are most at risk for terrorism tend to be wealthy and powerful. The people most at risk for street violence are poor and powerless. Our high-crime neighborhoods have had to pay the price for shifting of resources over to anti-terrorism initiatives.
Well, but then we also read about Homeland Security funds going to small towns in the West that are, you know, arming themselves. I mean, you know, there seems to be a perception that, in fact, small-town police agencies are getting funds from Homeland Security.
Sure, that's why you see that police departments in small towns have not seen any decline in the number of officers. The decline in the number of officers are in the big cities. So there's been no change in police resources in small towns in rural America, and there's been a big drop in resources in big cities across America.
Well, and yet a concern of the Bush administration and many local officials is that there isn't enough coordination. They want to be more involved. In addition to fighting crime on the streets, they do want to be more connected to the federal effort fighting terrorism. And the Wall Street Journal is reporting that there are going to be a lot of changes, more police liaison officers, new national operational center where local police can go and study, more permanent Homeland Security agents sent to states to stay there permanently at local intelligence fusion centers that are now operating so that everybody's getting this federal intelligence that some local officials said has been withheld from them.
Well, as long as the flow of information goes both ways, oftentimes it doesn't. The city police departments are dealing with local issues. They're dealing with crime in Mattapan and Roxbury.
That's here in Boston,
and,
yeah.
And Dorchester for Boston. And other cities have similar situations. We just can't ignore the high-crime neighborhoods because we're feeding into this huge anti-terrorism Homeland Security operation. Sure, Homeland Security is important, but so is hometown security. Let's not forget that. We shouldn't be taking from one to support the other. And if you look at Homeland Security, as you know, there's been much said, and correctly so, that money is not always being spent well.
Dr. James Fox, professor of criminal justice at Northeastern University. Well, Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez has finished his speech before the International Association of Chiefs of Police meeting here in Boston. Gonzalez reportedly did not offer new crime-fighting initiatives, but he did say the Justice Department role for now is to look for trends in gang violence, drug trafficking, and how inmates released from prison may have contributed to the increase in violence in cities. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Uh, A cold is working its way around our office. I'm trying to form a beachhead to prevent it from passing from Lynn to me to Chris in the next cubicle. Well, apparently one way to do that, don't loan either of them my pen. Previous research has shown that plenty of colds get spread by hand-to-hand contact, but can you get a cold from touching a surface? Dr. Owen Hendley of the University of Virginia Health System and his colleagues studied the ways in which a rhinovirus, which means a nose virus, can be transmitted from a person to a surface and to another person who touches that surface. Dr. Hendley, tell me what you found.
We did a study in which we took 15 adults from Charlottesville, from the community, who had a fresh cold, and we got them to stay overnight in an ordinary hotel room. And then the following morning, we went in and asked if they would point out to us 10 or 12 things that they had touched during their stay and tested for those for the presence of rhinovirus. And what we found was a little bit of a shock to me, I guess. There were 6 sites which were touched by almost everybody. These included the door handles, light switches, the hotel pen, a TV remote control, the telephone, and the faucet in the bathroom. And we found residual virus on 35% to 40% of those 6 sites, so all of them. Had virus a third of the time.
Right, and the viruses had stayed alive on these surfaces, which, some people think they don't live that long on surfaces.
Rhinovirus is a fairly tough virus, actually. Yeah. From work we had done previously, we found that if once virus dries down on a surface, it may be found alive for a couple of 3 days. Right. This is earlier work that we did. Right.
Well, we understand that you then did a second study a few months later, and this is kind of gross, but you had collected the mucus of the people with the colds, and you froze it, and you put it back in the room, and you brought them back to see if they would then pick up those viruses again. Now, we should say they couldn't actually re-catch their old colds, right?
Right. Well, we asked them to touch some of the surfaces which we had put a tiny drop of their own mucus on it an hour before or the night before, either one.
Right.
With the surfaces that we used was the upper surface of the light switch, the number 9 on the telephone dial, and the inner part of the telephone handset, and found that somewhere about 40% of the time they could get the virus onto their fingertip. So just because it's on the surface doesn't mean anything, but we think this demonstrated that not only if it's on a surface, it can be transferred to the fingertip of a person who's well.
Well, and again, they had already developed an immunity to it, so they couldn't recatch it. But you tested them, and they had it on their hands. So there you go.
There you go.
And you know, we understand, first of all, that your research was sponsored by a common household cleaner. It's Lysol. None of the research, and you don't have ties to that company. But some people have come to the conclusion that this means that, you know, you should clean a lot. Is that your conclusion?
You understand, I'm not opposed to cleaning a lot. That's a good idea. But I actually am more focused on my fingers. So what I do when I travel or when I'm out at my house and somebody has a cold is I'm very careful to wash my fingers before
hands.
I pick my nose or rub my eye.
Well,
because the virus is on your fingertip, it still doesn't infect. It has to be inoculated into the eye or the nose.
So it's a good idea to clean your house, too, what you're saying,
sure. This thing about the hotels, I mean, people going, ooh, the hotels are going to be horrified. But in point of fact, we did our sampling before the cleanup crew came. At my house, there's not a cleanup crew coming in there every morning so that it's all clean by that evening.
The hotels are probably cleaner.
I would imagine so, actually.
And Dr. Hendley, it could be what your mom always told you, which is don't stick your fingers in your nose or your eyes.
I've been listening to her for a long time. You don't have to wash your hands all the time. It's before you stick them in any of your orifices is when you really need to wash them.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you so much, sir.
All right.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye. Maybe more than we needed to know. Dr. Owen Hendley with the University of Virginia Health System. Stay with us. Mrs. Weasley is next, Here and Now. French actress Julie Walters has two Oscar nominations to her credit, one for Rita in the 1983 film Educating Rita, in which she plays a hairdresser who goes back to school, the other for the tough but caring dance teacher in the terrific Billy Elliot. But Julie Walters is probably best known now as Ron Weasley's mother in the Harry Potter films. Here she is in Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets, using a magical talking letter known as a howler to take Ron to task for driving off in his father's magic car.
How dare you steal that car? I am absolutely disgusted! Your father's now facing an inquiry at work, and it's entirely your fault! If you put another toe out of line, we'll bring you straight home!
My ears. Well, driving is also at the center of the new film Driving Lessons, which reunites Walters with actor Rupert Grint, who plays her son in the Harry Potter films. In Driving Lessons, he plays Ben Marshall, the son of an English vicar whose summer vacation is filled with Bible study classes. And underneath a repressed exterior, Ben has the soul of a poet, which begins to flower when he responds to a job posting with Evie, an eccentric actress played by Julie Walters.
I pay £6 an hour, which is a pound more than McDonald's. So if that is unsatisfactory, I suggest you go and work for them. Now, how you can consider such a thing in all good conscience, I really don't know. You ought to be ashamed of yourself.
From that somewhat inauspicious first meeting, Ben begins to work for Evie as an errand boy, driver, and ultimately forming a Harold and Maude-like friendship. Joining us in the studio to talk more about this exquisite little film are actress Julie Walters. Welcome.
Thank you.
We found it interesting. In Educating Rita, you played the student. Years later, in Driving Lessons, you're somewhat the teacher. Full circle?
Well, kind of, except that she also, they kind of mentor one another in this, because sometimes Evie is more the child in the situation than Ben is. Do you know what I mean? I feel it's a mutual thing. But I know what you mean. It is kind of full circle, because I suppose you could say that with Educating Rita as well, that they mentor one another.
Well, and that circle is drawn by the writer and director of Driving Lessons, Jeremy Brock, who also joins us in the studio. And Jeremy, I know you'd been working on this screenplay for 5 years. And it was based on something from your childhood. What was that?
It was based on a friendship that I formed with Dame Peggy Ashcroft, a famous, iconic English actress, before she died. I was that dysfunctional vicar's son living in that suburban world, and I needed to break out. I got a job cleaning for her, and the friendship that we forged formed the basis of the friendship between Ben and Evie.
You know, you talk about the dysfunctional family. We hear it sort of muffled behind the walls, but yeah, we hear what's going on. And at one point, the mother of this young Ben comes in and leans over him, and I wrote it down. She says, "Whatever happens behind these walls, we're God's ambassadors. We show the world a smile on our face."
Mm-hmm.
Is that your childhood?
That is partly how I experienced it, yes. I came from a controlled background. My mother, bless her, was very evangelical. And I have found in my experience that evangelism tends to infantilize people a little. It's very rule-bound. And my mother found that very convenient. It compartmentalized her world. And I was very constricted by that and wanted to break out, rather as Ben does.
And into Ben's life comes Evie, played by you, Julie Walters. How fun was this character?
Oh, every sort of fun. First of all, she's an actress, which is, it's fantastic to play that, because you can play all the vulnerability and everything that an actor's got with it, but not have to suffer it too much yourself at the same time. But also, she runs the gamut of just about everything, and she has no front. So you get to play her fragility and her strength. She just sort of skids from one thing to another. It's just fantastic.
And she loves the theatre. And the character is someone who, you know, breathes Shakespeare, but is best known for playing a role in a soap opera. What's the line? What's her famous line in the soap opera?
I'm a woman, Leland, not an oil tanker.
Have you been in that position also to be known as, you're the one on the hand commercial or...
Oh, yeah. I can remember that, walking along the street and a boy saying, "You're that woman from the tea advert," and being absolute... I was younger then. I was really hurt by it. I wouldn't be now. I'd quite understand it. But then I was. Excuse me, I have played at the National Theatre on stage. How dare you?
But with Ben, with this young man that comes into your character's life, you get to live what you love, which is Shakespeare. Let's listen to a scene where they both just start performing Shakespeare scenes, including Coriolanus, A Midsummer Night's Dream, Othello. Let's listen.
Ill met by moonlight, proud Titania.
What jealous Oberon! Fairy, skip hence! I have forsworn his bed and company.
Tarry, rash wanton, am I not thy lord?
I must be thy lady.
Kill me tomorrow! Let me live tonight!
Nay, and you strive.
But half an hour!
Done, there is no pause.
Above all, I say one prayer.
'Tis too late.
Julie Walters, I'm imagining there are very few opportunities to have a scene like that in modern film.
Oh, yeah. I mean, this part is completely unique. That parts for women my age are, you know, scarce on the ground anyway. But parts like this are just... Well, because she is a... You don't meet many people like Evie, but they do exist.
Well, and then there's Ben, again played by Rupert Grint, as we said, probably best known as your son, and the comic sidekick Ronald Weasley in the Harry Potter films. Jeremy, he is heartbreaking in this movie.
Oh, he's wonderful. I've always felt he was a wonderfully natural actor, even seeing him in Harry Potter. And he carries the movie. It's his story.
In one scene, he reads a poem to Sarah, a girl from his religious classes. He has a crush on her. Let's listen.
I do not sing for you, do not fly for you. I am not water, I am not wheat. I would be dove, I would be hawk. Your milky breasts, my strange meat. What do you think?
I'm sorry, but you're just too weird.
Well, just too weird. I mean, is this reflecting your adolescence as well, Jeremy Brock?
I'm ashamed to say I was a bit of a poet monkey. I did write some pretty odd poems. It was an expression of my zeal and my excitement about life. It's just I needed someone to nurture me and give me the confidence to grow up a little bit, which is what Evie does with Ben.
And was it what Dame Ashcroft did with you?
It was what Dame Peggy Ashcroft did for me, although the love story wasn't reciprocal as it is in this movie. She did make me feel like it was okay to say I want to be a writer.
Well, eventually, Evie, your stand-in for Dame Peggy Ashcroft, pulls Ben into a huge adventure that involves camping equipment and driving, which he doesn't know how to do yet. And I don't want to give away the ending, but I have to ask you, knowing your background, there's an unfortunate accident involving Ben's mother. Let's just put it that way.
Quite.
Are we seeing Jeremy Brock... wreak some vengeance on his mother in his new movie?
I hope not, but you are seeing Jeremy Brock do some pretty expensive therapy.
By making a film. Julie Walters, one last question to you. Are you a dame yet?
No, I'm not a dame.
Why
Fleming
the
should
heck
be.
Not? Yeah.
She should be.
Who do we write?
Let's start voting now.
Jeremy Brock, in the film, there's a scene where Ben is dancing in a bar in Edinburgh. We just have to ask you because we've never heard this combination. It's a salsa band, but there's also men in kilts with violins.
It is a unique sound, the band Salsa Celtica. I found them on a BBC radio station watched by about 10 other people. They were amazing, and I knew immediately that I wanted them. They combine a fusion of salsa and Celtic music from Scotland.
That's writer and director Jeremy Brock. We've also been speaking with Julie Walters. She stars in his new film, Driving Lessons. Thank you both very much for coming to talk to us.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for having
us. Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time.